This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and we begin today with the deadliest wildfire in California's history. The Camp Fire is burning in the northeastern part of the state and has destroyed more than 10,000 structures. More than 50 people are dead, and for thousands of others, they've left behind everything to escape.
I got a phone call around 7:30 telling me that my kid's school was being evacuated in Upper Medalia, so I immediately left work, went to head up the hill, and you could just see the cloud of black smoke engulfing the whole bridge.
It was a mad scramble to get off the mountain as fast as possible. People going down the wrong ways on streets, seeing fire and, you know, all around you. And at one point, we literally had to drive through the wall of flames just to get out.
Mariah Williams and Michael Bridges lost both of their homes in Megalia. In nearby Paradise, Jessica Shelton and Margaret Yamas have experienced similar devastation.
Five of my aunts and uncles and my mom lived in Paradise, and all of their kids. So there's like 40 of us from Paradise, and we've all lost our houses.
It looked like Armageddon. It was 9:30 in the morning, and it looked like 3 in the morning. That's how dark it was there. You couldn't even see. It was so dark. Our house completely is demolished, and my family and friends' homes are all demolished.
The four survivors told us their stories of trying to escape.
Some people had to leave their cars, and their tires were melting. My sister went over the fire trying to get out, and in her car.
You know, my kids are safe. My youngest son was missing for like 14 hours. My older son, their car ran out of gas, and all the gas stations were closed, and they ended up walking, and somebody picked them up.
We were freaking out down in Chico. At that point, it was still very much, it was my daughter and my best friend and I, and we still didn't know who got out, who didn't got out. We couldn't find her son. We couldn't find my mom and dad and the kids, even though I know my parents know those roads. It still was nerve-wracking.
So our first thing was to get, you know, clothes for our children, supplies, you know, toothbrushes, soap, shoes, just the little things that you don't think about. And when you don't have them, the things you need.
And for those lucky enough to escape, it's been a challenge to figure out what to do next.
We have so many friends that have nowhere. They're staying in shelters, or, you know, there's people in parking lots.
Just friends staying at parking lots and in tents, and just have nowhere to go. They had no family, and it's just, I feel so sad for them. It's just a nightmare, and it's still a nightmare for everybody.
We have been here since Thursday night. We're at the Super 8 in Redding.
I met up with all of my family before they all kind of scattered, because there's not enough accommodations in Chico for everybody. Even in Redding, I got one of the last rooms in Redding last night. So from Redding to Grass Valley, there's no rooms, which is a huge distance.
But a constant theme we heard from all of the victims of the fire were the ways in which the community has rallied together.
It's just people from all over are coming and donating. Here in Gilroy, my daughter and my sister posted something about it, and about how my husband and I and my sister ended up here in Gilroy, my sons. People started asking her, what's our address? For the last 3 days, we have been getting clothing, food, supplies, everything. There's one lady that wants me to call her because she wants to bring over on Thanksgiving a whole entire dinner for us. And it's just people even here, far away from the fire, are just coming together and helping, asking us anything we need, they're there. And it's just like, I've never seen anything like that, never.
We went to the Elks Lodge yesterday, and there's a huge line of people and a field that, oh my gosh, it's probably almost as big as a football field, and with tables with signs of sizes for kids and sizes for adults and shoes and toys and stuffed animals all organized and clothes and toiletries, and they were giving away gas cards.
It's very humbling just to see how everyone pulls together, especially at this time of year. You know, there seems like a divide of where you stand politically. Then with something like this, all that just washes away. It's really amazing to see everyone put aside their differences and just see everyone as human beings. And everyone has just been so helpful Even some of the big companies, you know, whether it's a free cup of coffee or food trucks, small businesses, people that can't afford things themselves are out there giving free food out of their food trucks 24/7. And everyone's just pulling together. It's been very humbling. It's nice to see that that still exists.
And now the question for all of the victims, how to recover when you've lost everything.
A lot of people were telling us they're never going back to paradise. I know I don't. My husband wants to go up to see if maybe he could find my wedding rings. We lost my wedding ring. We lost a lot. Pictures, all our birth certificates, wedding certificate, everything. You name it, we lost it all. There's nothing there.
It takes a piece of you. There's all of our memories. My wife's wedding dress that we wanted to get to our daughter. Everything. You know, we only have the clothes we went to work in that day. That's it.
You know, it's all of the heirlooms. My brother died when I was 14. And mementos from him. And pictures of him.
Right now, it's just one day at a time, trying to just get the basic survival needs and making sure those the others have what they need. And at the same time, you know, there's responsibilities that have to be done. And it's just kind of, once we start doing that, it gets very emotional of planning. And right now, our major concern is just our children. But yeah, I mean, soon we're going to have to sit down and start adulting, I guess you would say. Put the list together, find out where we're going to live. We need to get permanent housing set up here shortly.
It's like we're all in a state of shock. All of us, we're totally all in a state of shock. And we're going to apply for FEMA right now because the home we lived in, it was ours, basically, because my son bought it for us. And he said, Mom, do not worry. I'm taking care of everything with the insurance. Everything is going to be okay. So we just have to trust in that.
My mom and dad and I have had a conversation about, well, if we don't have a house at this point in time, we could just pick up and go. I'm an only child, so it's just my mom and dad and me and my kids and the dog. And yes, I have 400 million friends and family and people that I love, but we're kind of at the point that we might have to pick up and just go somewhere and start over.
There's a lot of people that don't have the support group that we have. And send gift cards, go to a GoFundMe page, find someone that's been affected and donate. There's a lot of needy families that have been misplaced and don't have homes and places to stay. So yeah, that's tough. We're not sure. It's something you never go through, so you know we're learning. What are the steps to do? And it's just kind of stumbling through it.
The stories of survival from Michael Bridges, Margaret Yamas, Mariah Williams, and Jessica Shelton, four residents of California who've lost everything in the state's worst wildfire. The story seems simple. Four male criminals die, and four women step in to finish the job.
We gotta start thinking like professionals. We're in business together. There's not gonna be some cozy reunion. After this job, we're done. We have 3 days to look and move like a team of men. The best thing we have going for us is being who we are.
That's Viola Davis in the new film, Widows. It's a heist film with shootouts and car chases, you know the drill. But it also digs deeper. Set in Chicago, the film revolves around race, gender, wealth, and even local politics. In other words, it's not your typical action movie. And that has a lot to do with the man behind the camera, director Steve McQueen, best known for his Best Picture winner, 12 Years a Slave.
I think it's a bookend to 12 Years a Slave. It's migration. Where we were then, and where we are now. The story continues.
I sat down with McQueen to learn more about how he got from 12 Years a Slave to Widows.
It's something which started 35 years ago, in fact. I was 13 years old, lying on my mother's and father's carpet, looking at TV, you know. And this program came on called Widows, written by Linda LaPlante. And it depicted these four women who were taking the reins of their husband's trade through their demise, meaning that the husbands had died in attempted heist. And these women had to sort of take up the slack, as it were. And what was interesting about it for me was, as a 13-year-old black child growing up in London, that these women sort of represented me in a way, when they were deemed as not being capable and they were being judged by their parents. So there was this relationship with them which was very strong, and I just loved the way they sort of circumnavigated all those stereotypes and put things on their head in order to sort of achieve their goal.
Let's talk about the pacing.
Sure.
So
it's fast.
It feels like it gets faster as we go through the film.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, absolutely.
What were some of the decisions you made in pacing this? Because I think there are some audience members who will come in expecting one thing because it's a thriller, action film. And this is a story that sort of unfolds with a lot of nuance and a lot of layers.
Well, this, as soon as you get into the theater, you know it's a sort of a heist movie. You're in there, it's a, let's go. So that's the action pace. The dramatic pace, which is the election. Okay, so there's another pacing. As well as on the third level of the emotional journey that these women take. It's been forced upon them and what they have to do in order to sort of achieve their goal. So then again, there's three streams which are sort of, you know, running parallel. It's almost like a cable. You're pulling and pulling and pulling and pulling. So it goes faster and faster and faster and faster and faster. And I love that because, you know, you're not bored. As an audience member, you have to be aware, crisscrossing all these lanes. So you're getting different sort of textures. You're in a rapid, and then you're in a chicane, and then you're in a waterfall. You know, it's kind of that. I love that kind of situation where the audiences are being rewarded for their attention and being sort of excited and thrilled and at the edge of their seats watching it because they don't know what's going to happen next. They don't know what's around the bend.
And that's really what it felt like. It felt like you weren't sure what was going to happen. And I think one of the themes that also came across to me in the film more broadly was power.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Who has it? Who doesn't? You mentioned a little bit, we talked a little bit about the election, but let's talk a little bit about how it plays out in the race for alderman between Colin Farrell's character and Brian Tyree Henry's. It's a very bleak look at local government. Was that the intent? And was it also meant to speak to specifically Chicago politics or just local politics in general?
I think world politics, we're looking at the local, but we're turning the telescope around, look at the global. You know, this is what the situation we're living in right now. So it's not about, you can talk about it, the bleakness of it, but the fact of the matter is the whole idea of politics and rivalry and competition and money and favors and backroom deals, that's everywhere in the world. We know that as a public. Let's not fool ourselves. It's not Steve McQueen putting a dark sort of tint on politics. I mean, is politics rosy right now in any way? No. You know, it's about bending rules. It's about getting away with it. It's about getting away with it in what way you can. This is happening all over the world. So I'm not trying to sort of fictionalize this in any way. I'm just sort of being very direct about it. I mean, in our picture, you have an interesting character who's a faith leader, again, who's, you know, to some extent compromised. So it's kind of, you know, it's the world we're living in. That's what I wanted to sort of portray.
Why Chicago?
Well, I went to Chicago 22 years ago. That was my first solo exhibition. I'm an artist, and I did a solo exhibition in the Museum of Contemporary Art there. And my girlfriend, who's my wife now, she went to the Democratic Convention at the time when Bill Clinton was the president. So I always say my first footprint in Chicago was art and politics. What fascinated me about Chicago was race, politics, corruption, police, religion, gender, et cetera, and also the fact that, you know, they had this town which was so segregated. Lithuanians, Irish, Hispanic.
Puerto Ricans.
Puerto Ricans, Dominicans, Mexicans. We could cut it into fine, all there. African Americans, you know, again, the whole spectrum. So no one was really rubbing shoulders. It was all segregated. And I love the idea of taking that fiction and steeping it into the reality of that location because it was so condensed. I wanted this to, I think it's just an amazing place for fiction.
You know, we're in this moment also talking about Hollywood. I mean, we've heard hashtag Oscars so white, yada, yada, yada. Is Hollywood in a better place now than it was a couple years ago? Or are we still struggling with institutional change?
No, it's changing. It's changing. It definitely is changing. You know, I think there are new voices in film. The film's getting made. These films are actually making money. So therefore, you know, studios want to make them. I don't know it's changing fast enough. You know, I want to see that film. I want to see that Puerto Rican film. I want to see that Asian film. I want to see those films, really, which, again, talk about us. I'm not interested necessarily types of people making pictures about them. It's about the city. Everyone's involved. Everyone's involved in how we live in our everyday. And I just feel that we need to see those voices. We need basically the people who pay money to go to cinema, they need to be represented on the screen. You know, I remember as a child, I was projecting myself as Sean Connery in 007 or even Johnny Wiseman as Tarzan. And the first time I actually saw myself in an interesting way was four women, you know. And, you know, they were like, two of them were white, one of them was Greek, and one of them was black. That was the original Widows.
So you're talking more about like not, I remember interviewing Marlon Wayans a couple of years ago about horror films, and he had made a horror film. And we were talking about the difference between, you know, is it a black horror film or is it just a horror film? Are you also equally, when you think about that, do you think about, you know, does this film have to not be labeled as a quote-unquote black film or a quote-unquote Latino film or an Asian film? This should be a film.
I want the best film. I don't care who's in it. When I was growing up, I was very lucky that I went to these cinemas, Repertory Cinemas, and I saw films from Japan. I saw films from Korea. I saw films from France. I saw films from Congo. I saw films all over the bloody world. And I, you know, my job wasn't to sort of say, oh, to categorize things in certain ways. It was about how people were talking and what was exciting for me at that time.
Steve McQueen is the director of Widows and 12 Years a Slave. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Go to omahasteaks.com and enter code TAKEAWAY into the search bar to get 74% off Omaha Steaks Family Gift Package, now only $49.99. Order now and you'll get four hand-cut age-to-tenderness top sirloin steaks, two savory premium pork chops, four chicken fried steaks, four Omaha Steaks burgers, four snappy kielbasa sausages, all beef meatballs, four perfectly browned potatoes au gratin, four made-from-scratch caramel apple tartlets, plus get four more burgers for free. Again, just go to omahasteaks.com, type takeaway into the search bar, and add the family gift package to your cart. Don't wait. Order today.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for being with us on The Takeaway today. It's Transgender Awareness Week. Yesterday, we visited Scotland, where schools are fighting homophobia with an LGBTQ-friendly curriculum. Today, we go to Tanzania for a different story. LGBTQ people are often targets of intense persecution there. Hundreds have fled a government crackdown on the nation's queer community after Paul Makonda, the leader of Tanzania's largest city, Dar es Salaam, vowed to arrest, quote, homosexuals in our city. He asked people to report homosexual activity while promising to hunt down LGBTQ people. Neela Ghoshal is a researcher for LGBT rights at Human Rights Watch, and she says this is just one slice of a major crackdown on civil and human rights in the country.
So about 2 weeks ago, the regional commissioner for Dar es Salaam, which is the largest city in Tanzania, said he would be setting up a 17-person task force that would go out and arrest everybody. He said that they would attempt to convert people who wanted to stop being gay, but that others would be subjected to forced anal examinations to test whether, in fact, they are gay or not, and that they would be jailed for 30 years to life.
Now, give us a sense, Neela. Is this something, I mean, I would imagine a policy or a stance on the LGBTQ community this radical isn't something that can just appear. Does the country have a history of persecuting the LGBTQ community?
Yes, this didn't come out of nowhere. Tanzania has had a law on the books since colonial times that was first put in place by the British colonizers that criminalized homosexual conduct. Post-independence, the Tanzanian government increased the prison sentence for homosexuality, and it's now 30 years to life, which is one of the worst sentences in the world. Now, Tanzania has not historically convicted people under these laws. They're more in place to force people to remain underground and to keep a low profile and to silence that community. But what we've seen is that since the new government came into place under John Magufuli in 2015, the crackdown on LGBT people by the police, by other government officials, has become much more proactive.
So tell us, are there mass roundups happening? And if so, what rights do the folks have that are being detained by police?
Over the past 2 years, again, under Magufuli's government, there have been a series of roundups. So what's happening now is not out of the blue under this government either. There have been cases in which people have been arrested simply for attending HIV prevention workshops, We've had lawyers arrested for holding a strategy meeting with LGBT activists to talk about how to push back against these violations of their rights. Now, what we've seen in the last couple of weeks since Makonda, the regional commissioner in Dar es Salaam, made his announcement is that there has been some walking back of his hostile rhetoric by the Tanzanian government. There is an indication that he is being restrained to some extent. His task force doesn't seem to have started working, but we've still seen a few arrests, and we're also seeing an uptick in cases of violence. So the public taking justice into their own hands and attacking people that they suspect of being LGBT.
So that was my next question. What is the community doing? Is there any recourse for folks who feel like they're being persecuted? And generally, what's been the response from the community?
Well, people are really scared. I talked to a number of activists living in Tanzania, and those people are really living in fear right now. A few of them have left the country, and others have stayed in Dar es Salaam, but are just staying at home as much as they can. Now, there's not much, unfortunately, in place in terms of recourse, because the law in Tanzania does criminalize same-sex conduct. There are South African lawyers who are involved in trying to advise the lawyers on the ground in Tanzania. So it's not like people are without any form of support, but they're operating in a really scary and restrictive environment.
Nila Ghoshal is from Human Rights Watch. Thank you, Nila.
Thank you.
The long and winding road to Brexit has gotten even more complicated. On Wednesday, British Prime Minister Theresa May presented her latest draft of a UK Brexit deal to her cabinet. But to the dismay of Brexit hardliners, that preliminary agreement does not represent the clean break from the EU that many supporters had been hoping for. As a result, two members of May's cabinet resigned over the proposed draft. And the stakes are only going to get higher for the British Prime Minister going into 2019. If May isn't able to negotiate an exit plan by March, the UK's membership in the EU will expire, deal or no deal. Jason Douglas is a Wall Street Journal reporter based in London. Thanks for joining us, Jason.
My pleasure.
So can you give us a sense of what the draft deal with the EU was that Theresa May brought to her cabinet earlier this week?
Okay, the draft agreement that she brought to her cabinet is the culmination of almost 2 years of negotiation between London and Brussels over the terms of the UK's departure. Broadly speaking, it keeps the UK pretty close to the EU in economic terms and in other ways. A lot of people here think that's pretty important, considering that the EU is the UK's biggest market for its exports. There are all sorts of trade and security ties and lots of other things that sort of link the two places together. So it's a deal that keeps it pretty close. That has upset quite a few people here who wanted a much clearer break with the EU, and these guys are sort of kicking up a bit of a fuss.
Now, are these the ones who have resigned as a result? We were hearing about a lot of resignations following that proposal.
That's right. So Theresa May brought her withdrawal deal to her cabinet on Wednesday for them to approve. She managed to get through that day without anyone quitting, but today we've had a couple of resignations of her senior ministers, a chap called Dominic Raab, who was her sort of chief Brexit negotiator, and then the Work and Pension Secretary, Esther McVeigh, has also quit. At the time we're speaking, there's been maybe half a dozen of junior ministers in her government have also left.
So I'm curious, Jason, if the Brexit negotiator resigns from a Brexit deal, does that not bode well for Brexit? I mean, it just feels like that's a key person to have in this conversation.
Exactly. The Brexit secretary is the man who resigned. That's his proper title. He's Secretary of State for Exiting the European Union. He is nominally in charge of the Brexit process and a lot of the negotiations. But then there are also people, civil servants operating through number 10 Downing Street, the Prime Minister's office, who are also playing a big role in this. So it's not quite as straightforward as it seems, but I admit that must be slightly confusing for listeners.
And the question I have is, what is really the concern here? Is the concern that the UK and the EU will continue to have ties? Because it seems like that's a yes but no relationship, and not exactly how I would imagine Brexiteers wanted to really cut ties with the EU.
Right. So the ardent supporters of Brexit wanted to really sever ties to the EU and to make sure that the UK could sort of strike out on its own across the world, sign trade deals with the United States, with Japan, with all the other places that they are keen to do. In terms of the detail of the withdrawal agreement, there are a few things that they have particular issue with, which we can briefly run through if you like.
Sure.
One is Theresa May's plans for quite a close customs arrangement with the EU. This would effectively leave the UK and the EU in a customs area together, meaning that the UK and the EU would have the same tariffs on goods. This has a lot of benefits in that it would help manufacturing companies across Europe and in the UK to sort of keep their supply chains flowing without any sort of disruption. But it does make it a lot harder to strike trade deals with other countries, and this is one of the Brexiteers' big issues. Their second main concern relates to Northern Ireland. The customs union and Northern Ireland are related. Both sides in this Brexit debate are very keen to avoid the reemergence of a border of customs checks, border inspections, border posts, that kind of thing, between Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK, and the Republic of Ireland, which is remaining an EU member. Many of your listeners will remember the troubled history of that region. People worry that if a border was to go back up, then some of these troubles might reemerge. The way they've sort of squared all this is the thing that really annoys the Brexiteers, because basically the withdrawal agreement doesn't allow the UK to exit this arrangement by itself. There's no unilateral way for the UK to get out of this so-called backstop agreement. The EU and the UK will have to decide together to bring this to an end. And this is one of the things that the Brexiteers are really irritated about. They want this whole Brexit focus for the UK to take back control, to be a sovereign country, and they feel this goes against that.
And I was just going to ask you about Theresa May, because she is also deeply unpopular, and I'm wondering where she stands on this. I mean, how long does she have to push this plan forward?
Right. The European Union leaders are due to meet at the end of November, November 25th, to sign off on this. Theresa May, it's hard to say how much time she has. At the minute, there's a lot of disquiet in her party. She may well face a no-confidence vote from some in her party within the week, within days. Most people think she would probably win that. But then her main challenge, and it's arguably a bigger challenge than getting it past her cabinet, is getting this deal through Parliament. She just spent the last couple of hours trying to sell this deal to lawmakers in Parliament on both sides of the House and got a pretty rough time of it. There's a lot of opposition, both from the Brexiteers, who we've been talking about, but then also from people who are quite pro the EU and would like the UK to have another vote on whether or not to actually leave. They want to be able to put the terms of Mrs. May's deal to the public and give them a choice, now that they know a little bit more about the terms under which they're leaving, to either accept this deal or to just decide to stay in the EU. So it's going to be very, very hard for Theresa May to actually get this deal through Parliament. So really, I mean, the thing to take away from all this is that there's a lot of options still open. There are lots of ways Brexit could still play out. One is the UK could leave next year with some sort of negotiated agreement. Another is the UK could leave next year with no deal at all, which would be very, very damaging to its economy. And then another is that there could be another vote. And who knows, perhaps the UK might decide to stay in the EU after all. So there's really lots of options are in play.
Now, there is a deadline approaching. And if none of these options pan out, what happens then?
The big worry is that you get to March 29th next year without a deal, without any clear instructions from Parliament, and then the UK could just fall out of the EU with no deal. And that is generally considered to be a very bad thing. You would have the prospect of pretty severe disruption to trade, commerce, travel between the UK and the rest of the European Union. So this is kind of an option that no one wants to happen, really.
Big story to keep on following. Jason Douglas is a Wall Street Journal reporter based in London. Jason, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
That's our show for today. But we've got one more thing for you. At a time when the news cycle can feel like pretty much one tragedy or bitter partisan fight after another, we here at The Takeaway want to let you know we feel you. So to fight back, we're launching a new project called America the Kind, and we need your help. We're looking for stories of people doing something nice for each other. That's right, nice. It could be small, maybe your neighbor cleared away the leaves in front of your house, or a barista complimented you and brightened your day. Or maybe a friend stepped up in a big way when you were going through a hard time. Or you know someone who volunteers and always goes above and beyond. Do you have a story from your community about an act of altruism? Or has somebody been just really kind or nice to you? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253 with your story. And we might feature you on the show. That's 877-8-MY-TAKE. Or head to our website and fill out the nomination form. That's at thetakeaway.org/AmericaTheKind. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. And do me a favor, go be kind to someone.